February 16, 1962, Lecture 29, Electromagnetic Radiation. February 16, 1962, Lecture 29, Electromagnetic Radiation. February 16, 1962, Lecture 29, Electromagnetic Radiation.
Today's lecture is on the subject of electromagnetic radiation. The most dramatic moment during the 19th century in the development of physics occurred to J.C. Maxwell one day in the 1870s. The dramatic moments of physics are those moments in which great syntheses take place. That is, where two things which appeared up to that time to be different are suddenly to be discovered be different aspects of the same thing, because the history of physics is a history of these syntheses, and the success of the physical science is mainly that we are able to synthesize. So one of the greatest syntheses of the 19th century was the synthesis of the laws of electricity and magnetism with the laws of the behavior of light. So there were not two things, but only one. For this culminating moment, there was a long preparation in the gradual discovery and unfolding of the laws of electricity and magnetism. And this story we shall reserve for a detailed study next year. In addition, the properties of light were partly unraveled, that old and subtle stuff that's so important and mysterious that it was felt necessary when writing about Genesis to arrange for it a special creation. It was appreciated to be a mysterious and wonderful thing. Yet what Maxwell could say when he was finished with his discovery was, "Let there be electricity and magnetism, and there was light." What Maxwell discovered was this. The gradually discovered properties of electricity and magnetism, and electric forces of attraction, repulsion, magnetic forces, show that although they were complex, they all fell off inversely as the square of the distance. You know, the simple Coulomb law for stationary charges. The electric field force varies inversely as the square of the distance. As a consequence of that, at sufficiently great distances, there's very little influence of one electrical system or charges on another. Maxwell noted that the equations or the laws that had been discovered up to his time, when he tried to put them all together, were mutually inconsistent. And that in order for the whole system to be consistent, he had to add another term or another law term onto his equations. And with a new term, there came an amazing prediction. And that was that a part of the fields, the electric and magnetic fields, would fall off much more slowly with the distance than the inverse square, namely, inversely as the distance. And so he saw that electric currents in one place can affect results far away. And he predicted all the effects with which we're today familiar in radio transmission, radar, and so on. The miracle that somebody talking in Europe can, with radio waves, be heard here, an influence over a very large distance due to electrical influences. It's because they do not satisfy the inverse square, but go down and only inversely as a distance, which is what Maxwell discovered. All these phenomena we summarize under the word radiation, or more specifically these days, electromagnetic radiation, there being one or two others that sometimes people use, but almost always radiation means electromagnetic radiation. And finally, then, the long familiar light was seen to be electric and magnetic influences extending over vast distances, but generated this time by an almost incredibly rapid oscillation of the electrons and atoms. And thus the universe is knit together. The atomic motions of a distant star still have sufficient influence at this great distance to set the electrons in your eye in motion. And so you know about them. If this law didn't exist, we'd all be in the dark about the exterior world. It's an accident. And the electric surging's in a galaxy 5 billion light years away, which is the furthest we've ever found anything so far, can still influence in a significant and detectable way the currents in a great dish antenna of a radio telescope. And so it is that we see the stars, and if you don't know what the right word is, hear the galaxies, or at least receive radio signals from them. And this phenomenon, which is so remarkable, is what I want to discuss today, because in our discussion of light, we have, of course, to make a real theory of it to discuss the correct, as far as we know, the better theory of it than the simple models. Now, at the beginning of this course in the physics, we outlined our picture of the world, but you're now better prepared to understand some aspects of it, and so I'll go over it again in some parts of it in greater detail. In particular, I would like to describe the position of physics at the end of the 20th century. That would be very handy if it were possible. At the beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th century. At the end of the 20th century, all that was known about fundamental laws, end of the 19th century, all that was known about fundamental laws can be summarized this way. First, there was a law of forces, and that one force was the law of gravitation, which is we've written down several times, and if an object has a certain mass, the force on it due to another mass is given by a formula that the force is equal to a unit vector in the direction of the other radius. Let E sub r be a unit vector in the direction of the other mass. R be the distance, so the force is inversely is the square of the distance. It's directed in the direction of the unit vector from this point to here. Is that right? Yes, it's attraction. And multiplied by G and the product of the two masses. That's the law of gravitation. Now, the laws of electricity and magnetism, as known at the end of the 19th century, are these. That any forces are given by the rate of change of the mass times the velocity divided by the square root of 1 minus the velocity squared divided by an important natural constant, which is called the speed of light, but of course is fundamental constant, 3 times 10 to the 8 centimeters a second. And that when non-electrical forces, so gravity acts this way, and electrical forces act as follows. Oh, I see, I drew this toward the object, eh? All right, I will like it toward the object. The electrical force law works like this. If Q is the charge carried, then the forces on anything can be described by two fields, and then also E and B, and it depends on the velocity of the charge on which the fields are acting, if you will, and is given this way. Now, to finish the laws, we have to say what the formulas are for E and B in a given circumstance, just like we say what the gravity law is. And the rule there is the following, that the E and the B is the sum of contributions from each individual other charge, or each individual charge. That is, if I can find the E and B from a single charge, then I need to add all the effects from all the universe, all the charges together, to get the total E and B. I must add them together. That's the principle of superposition. So the whole of electrodynamics, all the laws of nature known in the end of the beginning of the 20th century, can be given now by telling you what the formula is for the electric and the magnetic fields from an individual charge. It turns out that that is very complicated. And it takes so much study and so on that that's not the point now. If I write it down, which I'm going to do, I write it down only to impress you with, so to speak, the beauty of nature, that is, that it's possible to summarize all the fundamental knowledge on one blackboard with notations that you're now familiar with. However, the way I'm going to write the law down for the fields of the individual charge is complete, accurate, as far as we know, but it's going to look kind of complicated, and we won't have, or not, the purpose of writing it down is not that you study all the pieces now. I am only writing it down to give an impression so that to show that it can be written. So you see ahead of time roughly what it might look like. As a matter of fact, the most convenient way to write down the correct laws of electricity and magnetism are not the way I'm going to write, but involve what's called field equations, which we'll learn about next year. But then mathematical notations are different and new. And so in order for me to write it, I have to write it in an inconvenient for calculation form, but easy to write in notations that you know. And so I write the following law. The electric field is given by minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon 0 times a unit vector in a direction of the radius to the charge divided by the square of the charge distance. That you say, oh yes, that's Coulomb's law. That we know already, that the forces, electric field produced by, this is the charge that's producing, this is the charge that's producing the field. This is the charge on which the field is acting. This is the charge that's producing the field. This is the vector in the direction of this charge, Q, let's call it here, and we want to calculate the field at this point. Then if they let this distance be r and the unit vector be er, then this would be Coulomb's law. Well, Coulomb's law is wrong. The discoveries of the 19th century showed that influences cannot travel faster than a certain fundamental velocity, which we now call the speed of light, c, and that it is not right that it is Coulomb's law, because it is not possible to know where the charge is now and what distance it is now. The only thing that can affect the field here is the behavior of the charge in the past. How far in the past? The time delay, or retarded time, so-called, is the time it takes light, or time, any signal, to get from the object of charge to the present position. So I must calculate the your next guess is, if I put a little prime on here, meaning that I see how far it was away, not now, but how it would look if the information came to me at the speed c. Just for a moment, suppose that in a sense it was lit up and that the light could only come at the speed c. Then when I look at it, I wouldn't see where it is now, of course. I'd see where it was if it's moving, because what I have to write is the formula for a complicatedly moving chart. And so what we talk about here is the direction, apparent direction, the direction that used to be, the retarded direction, and the retarded distance. So that would be easy enough, too. But that's also wrong. It's much more complicated. The next corrections, there are several terms. The next term is this. It's as though nature were trying to fix it up for the fact that it's retarded, if I might put it very crudely. We're not trying to understand this law, but for those who might make some effort, I'll say a little bit about what some of the terms seem to me to mean. The next term is this. It says if you calculated this delayed Coulomb field, add a correction to it, which is the rate that it's changing times the time delay that you used. It's an attempt to bring the field to the present time to guess what it's going to be at now. You see, it's used the delayed positions, but it corrects it by taking the rate that is changing and adding the time that it's delayed it. But never mind, it's not finished yet. And if you've explained all this, you're still not done. There's a third term, the second derivative with respect to t of the unit vector in the direction of the charge. How now I am finished. And that's all there is to the electric field from a fixed charge and the magnetic field moving anyhow. A prime, all delay. And the magnetic field is minus 1 over the speed c times the unit vector in the r direction, prime, delay, cross the electric field that we have over here. So that's the whole story. Now, I've only written those down for the purpose to show you the beauty of nature, in a way, the power of mathematics, or what have you. We don't understand why it's possible to write so much on such a small space. But this contains the machinery by which electric generators work, how light operates, all the phenomena of electricity and magnetism and the responses, provided we know something about the behavior of the materials that are involved, matter, which we don't have described correctly here. At any rate, in these, what I've written down is a synthesis of electricity, magnetism, electromagnetic waves, light, and everything else. To finish with the description of the picture of the world in the 20th century, I must add that there was one other great synthesis that had occurred, in fact, one in which Maxwell had a great deal to do also, and that was the synthesis of the phenomena of heat and mechanics. And that subject we'll study next trimester, the third part of this course, the relation between mechanics and heat. Now, what had to be added in the 20th century was this, that the laws were all wrong, and that quantum mechanical effects have to be added to correct them, because they're all wrong in a certain sense, that they're approximate when the scales of things are large. So the first correction is quantum mechanical. In addition, however, beside the fact that this has to be made into quantum mechanical laws, which are called quantum electrodynamics, there were discovered a number of new phenomena, of which the first was radioactivity, discovered by Becquerel, 1898, just got it in under the 19th century. And this phenomenon of radioactivity, when followed up, produced a knowledge of nuclei and new kinds of forces that are not gravity and not electricity, new particles and so on, a subject which has still not been unraveled. For those purists who know more, the professors who happen to be in the audience, I would say, when I say that this was a complete solution of all the knowledge of the electrodynamics, you may realize that there was a problem that was not quite solved, and that was when you calculated the field, it was not solved at the end of the 19th century. When you calculate this field from all the charges, including the charge itself, that you want the fields to act on. You must add all the charge, including the charge itself on which you want the field to act. You get into a whole lot of trouble trying to find the distance, for example, of a charge from itself and divide something by that distance, which is zero. And so the problem of how to handle the field, the part of this field, which is generated by the very charge on which you want the field to act, was a problem which was not solved at the end of the 19th century and is not yet solved today. So we leave that. That's still the same situation. We have not got a complete solution to that puzzle yet. But we avoid that puzzle for as long as we can. This, then, is a summary of the world picture. And what I want now to use it for is to discuss the phenomena of radiation. And to discuss the phenomena of radiation, I must select from this equation for the field only that piece of the field which varies inversely as the radius and not as the square of the distance. And it turns out that if I finally do select that piece, it is so simple in its form that it's a legitimate process, I think, to study optics and electrodynamics in an elementary way by taking as granted the existence of this law of the electric field produced by a charge far away, the part of the electric field which goes 1 over the distance instead of 1 over the square of the distance. And let us take it temporarily as a given law, which we will learn about next year. The terms here, this is evidently inversely as the square of the distance, and this is only a correction for delay, so it's easy to show that both of these vary inversely as the square of the distance, and that all of the stuff that we're interested in comes from this, which isn't very complicated after all. Because what this says is, look at the charge and see the direction, the unit vector. And you can project the end of it on the surface of a sphere. It's a unit vector. And as the charge moves around, the unit vector wiggles. And the acceleration of that vector is what we're looking for. That's all. And that is a statement of the laws of light. Because that's the only thing that's important when we get far enough away that the fields are varying inversely as a distance. In other words, when we're dealing with the part of electrodynamics which is called radiation. Radiation is called that part of the field which varies as you get far away, only inversely as a distance, in which you say, well, the things that go as a square of the distance have fallen off so much that we're not interested in them. Now, I can go a little bit further in studying this term to show you what it means this way. If we had a charge moving anyhow, we'll come back to that in a minute. If we have a charge moving anyhow and we're over here observing it, And we imagine for a moment, in a sense, that it's lit up, although it's light, which we're trying to explain, but I mean so that you can imagine that you saw it as an individual white dot. Then you'd see that you'd have to look in a certain direction. You'd see this white dot running around. Of course, you don't see exactly how it's running around right now because of the delay that we've been talking about. What counts is how it's moving earlier. Now, this unit vector that I've been of which I've been speaking is pointed in this direction. And as it moves around, of course, it goes on a slight curve. So that the acceleration, the second derivative, has two components. One is a transverse piece, because at the end of it, it's going up and down. But the other is a complicated piece that has the radial piece, because it's going in a curve. It's easy to demonstrate that that's much smaller and varies when the distance is very great. You see, if I imagine that I take this same source and put it further and further away, then the wigglings, the image looks smaller and smaller. Inversely is the distance, the angles. And the wiggling of this vector is weaker and weaker. And of course, the component of acceleration in this direction is varying much more rapidly than inversely is the distance. So for practical purposes, all we have to do is project it on a plane. And therefore, we find the following rule. Imagine that you look at the object and that everything you see is delayed, like a painter trying to paint a scene at a screen at a given distance. But unlike a real painter who doesn't take into account the fact that light goes at a certain speed but figures it's instantaneous, we want to see what the picture would look like with that delay. And then we see a dot representing the charge moving about. The acceleration of that dot is the electric field. That's all. That's exact. That's all we need. That's the law of radiation. From that piece, all the phenomena of radiation come. So the idea is project the picture with a delay on a screen at a unit distance. A plane screen is good enough. And the acceleration of that point is the electric field. When multiplied, there's a square of the speed of light here. By multiplied by the suitable constant, namely minus Q over 4 pi epsilon 0 c square times the rate of the acceleration of the projected point. Now I can go still further. In many examples, we need that formula as described. Well, this would be at the moment the acceleration of the projected image or the projected point on the screen. But in our applications, we'll take a case that's on for a long time. In fact, I don't know that we'll do any other case, in which the object that's moving, which is generating the source, is moving slowly compared to the speed of light. It may be oscillating rapidly, but it's moving such a small distance that we don't have to worry about relativity effects, which are all contained, by the way. It's all right the way I said it. But I want to make an application of it to a still simpler circumstance in which the charges are moving only a little bit at a relatively low rate. Since they're moving at a relatively low rate, they do not move an appreciable distance away, so that the delay time is practically constant. And then the law is still simpler because the delay time is fixed. So we imagine that we have a charge executing a very tiny motion at an effectively constant distance. Now we have the law that I'm really going to use, and it goes like this. Since the delay is constant, and the delay, if the distance is r, is effectively a constant, then r over c is the time of delay, or retardation, time of delay. And then that rule is the following. If the object has an actual position, suppose that the object is moving in a very small motion here, and I stand here and I look. Then if it's displaced at distance x, the angle, the unit vector is displaced. This unit vector here has a size in this direction, which is x over r by a proportion that this is a unit length, and this is the length r, so this is x over r. And so the acceleration of e, since r is practically constant, is simply the acceleration of x itself. And so I finally get the law that we want, which is the following. Minus q over 4 pi epsilon 0 c squared, inversely is r, and multiplied by this, the acceleration of the actual charge retarded in time Now let's use the technical word. They kind of call it delay, but they mean, we say retarded. And only the component perpendicular to the line of sight is important. Now let's see why that is. Because evidently, if the thing is moving this way only, and I look at it, and it moves in and out at me, the unit vector in the direction doesn't wiggle at all, and there's no acceleration of it. So it's only the motion up and down which is important. It's only the acceleration that I see on the projected screen. Any acceleration toward the screen is not of any importance. So the fundamental law that we must take and we're going to assume is true is that the electric field produced by an accelerating charge, which is not moving relativistically, at a very large distance r, when we're far enough away, approaches this form. That it's a lot of constants that vary inversely as r. It's proportional to the charge. It varies inversely as r, and there are some constants. But the dynamic, the important thing is that it's proportional to the acceleration of the actual charge projected onto the line of sight that you have, and that this acceleration is not today's acceleration, but the acceleration that it had at an earlier time. The amount of delay retarded by a time r over c. That is the fundamental rule that I would like to assume is known. And so the present lecture is designed to discuss this law a lot so that you can appreciate it better physically, because we are going to use this element to understand all the phenomena of light and radio propagation. And therefore, this is a central law, and it's all we need. All the rest of the stuff that I put down before was only to put the stage into which the thing goes, so you'll know later what this piece of junk that I'm borrowing from nowhere, where it fits in, and when you'll learn how it comes about. We'll learn this next year. In the meantime, we try to accept it as true, but not just on a theoretical basis. I'd like to show a number of experiments which illustrate the character of this law. In order to do so, I have to have an accelerating charge, and I take a charge accelerating very rapidly. It should be for a single charge. But if I can make a whole lot of charges move together all the same way, since the field is the sum of the effects of each of the individual charges, I just add this together. I forgot to say, we must add this together for all the different charges. So if they're all moving together, of course, it's just more of the same. It's just bigger. It makes effectively, it just increases the total charge. And what we have over there is a piece of wire like this and a piece of wire like so that's connected to a generator. And the idea is that the generator makes a potential difference or a field, which pulls the electrons away from here and pushes them into here at one moment, and then an infinitesimal time later, it reverses the effect and sucks the electrons, if I may put it that horrible way, out of this thing down into the generator and pumps them back into here. So that in these two wires, there's motions, the charges do like this, but they oppose each other. And it's easy to see from thinking about the summing effect that this doesn't produce any effect for us. What is important is the fact that charges are accelerating, let's say, upwards in this wire and upwards in this wire for one moment. And a moment later, they're accelerating downwards in this wire and downwards in this wire. The fact that there are two wires and all that in the generator is merely a way of doing it. What we have in the net result, because this all cancels out, is that we merely have a charge accelerating up and down, if you will permit me to imagine this as one single wire. So in this wire, as a result of this generator, by pumping the charges in and out, we have the effect that charges accelerating up and down. And then we have the circumstance that we need for this law. Now this tells us that we make an electric field. So we need an instrument to detect an electric field. And the instrument we made is the same darn thing. Thus, a pair of wires in space, so. Now, if an electric field is applied to such a thing, it will produce a force which will pull the electrons up on this wire and push them on that wire. Or pull them, push them, never mind, it goes this way. And it pushes it down into the terminals here and pulls them out of here. And so there's a little tiny fine wire which carries this information, this into the amplifier, and then it's amplified and then signals put on so you can hear it. So that when this thing feels an electric field, there'll be a loud noise coming out of the loudspeaker. And when there's no electric field driving it, there'll be no loud noise, and so it goes. And so with this equipment, I want to demonstrate this. It turns out that it's impossible. Because in the labyrinth, in this room, with the waves that I'm using, the effect of this is to shake, for instance, in this piece of metal here, other electrons. The electric field from here makes these go up and down, and these going up and down produces an effect here. Incidentally, I've already explained the principles of reflection of waves. This wave makes an effect here, which goes here. So that what has actually comes to this is not quite as simple as that. And so what I'm going to do, most of my experiment, will be to hold the things fairly close together so that the influences from the walls and from my own myself, the reflected waves, are relatively small. So the phenomena will not turn out to be precisely and perfectly the way as here, but they'll be close enough that I think you'll be able to appreciate the laws. Now, we turn the thing on, so you hear the signal from this, and I hear, too loud, is it? Well, that ought to be loud enough. Now, we have a strong field from here as advertised, and the same amount of field over here or at any other angle about, because it has no directional effect. On the other hand, when we come up here, the field is zero. Let's just check that that's right. It said that the field should be the projected, the acceleration of the charge, the acceleration of the charge projected, perpendicular to the line of sight. And therefore, if I'm looking down on this thing and the charge is moving toward me, there's no effect. So that's the first rule, is that there's no effect when the charge is moving toward you. Secondly, it says that the electric field here should be this way, and so if I hold the terminal as a perpendicular, I should get no signal. And I do. You see, I get a signal this way, but not that way, because the electric field is indeed vertical and not horizontal. In this region here, although I hold it this way, well, let's prove also that the electric field is not this way, because if I hold it this way, I also get no signal. I only get it when it's perpendicular, when it's this way, but not that way. Not, there's no field this way. It's all this way in a directional. When I come over here at this angle here, you'll see that the strongest signal occurs when it's something like that, because although this is vertical, moving this way, it doesn't produce a field that's moving that way. It's the projection of the acceleration perpendicular to the line of sight. That is, the line of sight is this way, and the acceleration that's seen is only this component. The signal is weaker at a given distance here than here. I don't know if you can hear that much. That's where the reflections get make the thing complicated. And goes towards zero as I get here, if I can get it accurately enough. Yeah. And as the thing described, because it's only the projection, remember, perpendicular to the plane of sight. And as I come up here, although if a thing is accelerating this way and I look at it so, there's very little motion in the plane of sight. Next, I would like to demonstrate what happens when we have two sources. And so, I put up another source here, and the law is that the two sources should add their effects, and when I connect this in, I suppose it should be loud, I hope. A little louder, because there's more source. So we have the two sources, and we have a louder effect. Because both of the sources, they're connected to the same generator, and they're both moving up and down in the same way. So that the total electric field is the sum of the two and is twice as strong as it was before, the field. Now comes an interesting possibility. Suppose I make this one accelerate up and down and this one accelerate up and down, but I delay this one. I make the timing so that they're going like this. Then the field that's produced by this one will be one way and the field by the other the opposite at any instant. And therefore, I should be able to get no effect by suitably adjusting the time of oscillation to this. Now, the time of oscillation of this is neatly arranged because here's a pipe which is carrying the signals over here. And by changing the length of it, we change the time it takes the signal to arrive there. And thus, we change the timing of that oscillation. And by moving this pipe in, I can find a place where there's no more signal left. In spite of the fact that they're both going, it can be seen because if I cut one out, you see the other one go. So two of them can produce zero if everything is okay. Now, a very interesting circumstance is to show that the addition of the two fields is, in fact, a vector addition. We just checked it for up and down, but let's check two directions. They're now back in phase. That is, they're both moving together. But I turn this one this way at 90 degrees to the way it was before. And now we should have the sum of two effects, one of which is this way and the other one is that way. So that should be something like this, that the electric field is the sum of this one and that one in phase. When they're both strong, the total field is here. As they come through zero together, the total field goes to here. As they go weak together, the total field will go here. And so I should be getting a signal at 45 degrees. So if I turn this to get the maximum noise, it should be about 45 and not vertical. You see, it is, more or less. And if I turn it at right angles to that, the direction of zero is easy to measure. The phases aren't exactly right. I didn't get it exactly. Oh, wait, here. Now we got it. See, it's nearly zero, and it's practically 45 degrees. When I get it zero, of course, what I'm doing is that I have the antenna set this way while the field is oscillating that way, and I get no signal. So you see, I add them vectorially. Now I took this back the way it was. If I turned it over or not, I don't know anymore. I suppose it's all right now because it's a strong signal. Oh, let's have some fun. Let's see if we turn it over, it gets to zero. Instead of believing this complicated thing, I'll just turn the field over. Not quite. That shows that I didn't tune this. Well, there's reflections. I can change it from where I am. There, now it's tuned better, see? Now it's better. So now I should make my 45 degree experiment. It'll work even better. Practically zero, I hope, and strong in this direction. Now, if I turn it over, I get zero, and if I turn it back, I get strong. So you see, we're adding vectors. Now, how about the retardation? The fact that the signal is retarded. How can we demonstrate that the signal is retarded? Well, you can measure the time at which it arrives and all that stuff, and with a great deal of equipment. But there's a very simple way. Do not forget that the signal takes a certain time to get from there to the antenna. And I can do this. Both of these are in phase. They're both shaking together. They produce an equal electric field here. But suppose I go to a place which is closer to this one and further from that one. Then in accordance with the principle that the acceleration should be retarded, let me get the noise out for a minute while I talk. In accordance with the principle that the acceleration should be retarded, the field that one produces is oscillating as this used to oscillate, and the field that the other is producing is oscillating as that used to oscillate. But if the used two are not equal, then they're not longer in phase. If this is oscillating rapidly up and down, it sees what the oscillation is in earlier time, and this sees what that one was in earlier time, so it should be possible to find an angle at which the distance from here and the distance from there differ in such a manner that there is no more signal. Let's see. So we put it as a signal. So I move it around in space, and lo and behold, I have now found a point where it's nearer to that one than that one. Don't believe it? We go still further. Now the difference is greater. A whole cycle, in fact. That is to say, the signal reaches from the first antenna first. Signal reaches from the second antenna with a delay in time that's greater than that of the first antenna by just the length of time it takes for the electric current to oscillate once, and therefore the signals, the electric fields are produced in phase here again. If I go still further, I hope I get another somewhere around there. No, the little tiny ones are due to reflections. The bigger ones, it's hard to, that's the trouble with the experiment. The little ones are reflections. This thing now is nearly at zero again, and now the difference is 1.5 oscillations in time. The difference in the delay corresponds to 1.5 oscillations. And if I go over here, it's strong again. And if I come here, it's nearly zero because I have set these 2.5 apart. To illustrate this point, I've drawn a figure which represent the situation. The two oscillators are set actually 25 centimeters apart, and it'll turn out, we'll measure it in a minute, that the time for one oscillation, and during the time of one oscillation, the signal can go, the waves go, or whatever the influence goes, the retardation corresponds to 10 centimeters. So when I'm over here, and they're both in phase, the signal is as strong as it can get, because they're both pushing together. When I come down here at a small angle, in such a manner that the difference of these two distances is 5 centimeters, then I see this at a I see the effect of this at a certain delay, but I see this at a delay of 0.5 cycle more. And therefore, when one has a positive field contribution, the other has a negative field contribution, and the result is nearly zero, weak. Then if I come in some intermediate region here, I can make it so there's a 10 centimeter delay between the two, and the two then go back again into phase. You know what I mean by in phase and out of phase. This is out of phase and this is in phase. Then I can find still a higher angle in which this distance difference between these two is 15 centimeters, which corresponds to one going through 1.5 oscillations, more delay. And finally, when I'm down here, since I set them 2.5 waves apart, I get no signal. You'll be amazed here that this is the first time that I prepared less to talk about than I needed the time to talk. And so, because I'm usually afraid, and this subject I felt was so important that I wanted to be sure to get everything in, so I've overdone it. However, I use the remaining time to show one or two other features of the thing. First, let us amuse ourselves by trying to measure the wavelength, that is to say, rather, the distance that this light or the speed c, the distance that speed c would correspond to in the time of one oscillation of these things. In other words, all we've got to do would be measure this distance. It's much easier to take the case in which we hold the antenna out here and get a zero, and then move this over in. And when we move it from a zero to a zero, it means that we moved it so that the delay of this one has been changed by exactly one oscillation. And if we measure how far we move it, that distance corresponds to how far light would go in the time of one oscillation. So what I would like to do would be to hold this thing out here parallel to these somewhere. Yeah, that's pretty good. And I'll first get a zero right about here. Of course, if I don't move around, it's better because I have a reflection. And I've set this thing so that that reads 10. I won't move. Wait a minute. I'll get a zero. I can't read it then. 9.5. And see, it goes loud. And then there, it's moved one whole cycle in distance. And it reads 19.2. Well, I'm not so hot at measuring. It's really accurately 10 centimeters. It moved by 9.8 or so, but it's pretty close. And so we measured the wavelength as 9 centimeters. Another interesting experiment is the following. Put the two things closer together. Let's put them where they were. Let's let me just check that there's a maximum here and there's a minimum there because it interferes. But suppose that the two waves were made to be at right angles. Then this should really be only listening to one of the two antennas because the other one is making a signal which doesn't feed it. And therefore, if I move it out, hopefully, but the reflections always box me on this one, I don't get much and there is some slight variation. There is some from the reflections. It doesn't work too well. But the thing that is interesting is that there is a place where I can get a bigger signal at 45 degrees. Now I'm getting an influence in here from both antennas. because their sets are, each one can influence. As I move it around, I hope I get the minimum required. But lo, by turning it to the other direction, 90 degrees, I get a strong signal again. It doesn't work too well. Well, let's see. Yeah, it works. While over here, it was the other way around. Let me explain why that is. If I put the things at equal distance from the two antennas, so that one antenna is oscillating vertically and the other horizontally, the two fields which are produced at the signal plate, at the detector antenna, are produced as a sum of the two electric fields and is therefore, as already explained, an oscillation like this. So if I set my antenna in this direction, I will get a strong signal. Now, when I move it a distance out here that corresponds to a time difference of distance difference of 5 centimeters, then let's say at a given instant, the signal from this one, maybe the vertical one, we'll say is this way. Then at that same instant, the signal from the horizontal one will not be like it was before, namely this way, but a time delay of half a cycle. So it appears late by half a cycle and appears this way. Therefore, the total wave that's oscillating is now in this direction. And when I hold my antenna vertically, it's true that there's a component of field which drives it, whether I hold it here or hold it here. And the only component which does drive it is the one antenna. But when I hold it at 45 degrees, then both antennas can drive this thing, and I get a certain signal. But when I move it to the interference spot, then they interfere this time perfectly. But if I turn the antenna back, there is a signal there. That's quite different than when they're parallel, because there, you see, I can recover the signal by turning the antenna. But when they're parallel, that's not possible, I hope. That is, I think I've turned them upside down. That's strong. Now I come over here, where it's supposed to be pretty weak. And if everything's right, if I turn it, it won't come back. You see, it doesn't. It's different because that time, in both antennas are up. And when I come to this other point, one is up and the other's down. And so the sum is zero. And there's no way to turn the antenna to recover it. But in this circumstance, there's still a field there because we're adding things in a different direction. It shows the vector character, shows the delay, shows everything. What I can't show easily, because it requires a quantitative measure, is that the field is directly is inversely as the distance. In order to do that, I would have to measure the strength of the field in one place and the strength of the field in another, and I can't make the quantitative measure because of the difficulties of the reflections. In order to illustrate the difficulties of the reflections to you, I make the signal, and I bring over a piece of something else. Now, let's just take one. It's easier. Although it's just as putting it down doesn't quite get rid of it. I better disconnect it. This thing produces a field in here, which produces a field over there. And if I change the distance, then the effects of this reach that antenna in a phase relation to the effects of that because of the difference in timing, so that we get a strong or a weak or a strong or a weak or a That's an interference, so-called, between the direct action of this on that and what you would like to call a reflected wave, but which I insist be understood in a different way, namely that this shakes the electrons here and those generate a new wave. Because only if we understand it in that fundamental way will we understand all the real phenomena. We can't talk about reflections and refractions so easily. We must understand each of the effects as due to the waves on the matter of something else. Well, that's the fundamental law that I want to understood, and we'll apply it to certain situations next time. Yes, there ought to be. Let's try it. There's all these guys walking around. You'll not be able to do an experiment. You have to wait till they go out. You see, as they walk around, you hear the variations as their heads move in and out.
What are you using as a detector here?
There's a little crystal, I believe. I'm not sure. I didn't make it. Mr. Mayor made it.
That must be a crystal in there, yeah.
There's a modulator over there that makes a note that's on top of the whole thing. So you can hear it, otherwise, yeah. Yeah. .45. Yes. But there was. I believe it was. This experiment can't be done easily here. That's right. I should have put them close. I put this closer. I forgot when I was trying it out. If it's closer to the sources, then it's loud enough that the reflections are unimportant, and I could demonstrate it. But there should be no... I'm always boxed by the reflections. Let's see. You wanted to try something? What did we want to try? Oh, whether it made a difference to tilt the plate. That's going to be hard to tell, because... When we're tilting the plate, we're also accidentally moving in and out, but we'll try it. Now I got a minute, but I don't know what the... Let's put it at the wrong angle, okay? Doesn't make much difference. And you know why that is? So yeah, angles equal angle equal angle. The real reason is the following, that this produces an effect in this part of the plate, and that affects that. It also produces an effect in this part of the plate, and that affects that. And it produces an effect in this part, and that affects that. But the distance, the timing is different for all the rays, and so all these different effects add and subtract from one another. So if the angle is wrong, there's no effect. Now, if the angle is right, there's a whole accumulation of rays which have nearly the same time. That's the way that the least time works. That all of the one in the center and all in the neighborhood are almost all in the same time, so they all drive it. But when the angle is wrong, for each effect from one of these pieces, the effect from another piece nearby is very, it cancels it out. But when the angle is right, then it all contributes together. And that's the secret of the reason for the least time. That was all right, huh? Okay. It was dull because of this nice apparatus. You want to try something? Yes. I don't know whether it's tuned. How the hell is it made? Is it tuned here already?
Must be,
and then carried down here. Partly detected, no doubt.
No doubt, there's a detector. That's a one end.
That looks like a little crystal, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a resonant detector.
Yeah, it's a crystal set.
Yeah,
it's a crystal.
No,
certainly not. So that's a crystal set.
And then you send the DC signal.
Yeah, practically, not quite. Just the signal of the audio signal.
Audio.
Yeah, the
whee.
Yeah. That's just technical, so you can hear it. So it's not DC. That makes the noise. It's easier that way. Yeah, the whole detector's right here. Yeah. What?
How many watts are you sending?
I don't know what the power is. Mr. Mayor, who set it up, isn't here. I don't know what the power is.
You're going to use it again?
No.
negative, right?
Yep. Change the time. Damn handy, huh? Okay. This is all you need. The rest of the lecture you can forget, except that this formula and a demonstration. If you need to forget something, please forget selectively. Huh? Forget the stuff that's least important first.
A couple of lectures ago when you made the demonstration about reflection of the radio waves.
Yes, not reflection, diffraction. I closed the hole and it got stronger.
Oh, yes. And then you said, well, to make the experiment with light, if you didn't believe the radio waves were
right.
Electromagnetic. I just wondered what you...
Not a philosophical question. I did it with radio waves, and I was talking about light. And I just thought you might also like to check that it works also with light. It's a question. I mean, I can tell you a lot of stuff about nature, but it's fun to check that it's true. And I can't make a demonstration with light that's easily visible to everybody in the audience, but it's easy for you because, you know, to make small dimensions and to try it and see that the same thing happens. The reason also was that the radio waves are unfamiliar, and the fact that they're exactly the same as light, maybe you don't believe until you've had a check on it of some kind. And I would prefer to have done the experiment with light, which is what I was talking about, but it was technically difficult, and I was saying, I'll do it with a different length of wave, the 3 centimeters, this is 10 centimeters, and you do it with a 20 thousandths of a millimeter. For what?
Yeah, I guess they want this thing.
You want this thing?
You need it next time.
All right. You don't need any more. It's all been explained.
Okay. Let's turn it on. I'll take care of it.